Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have legendary comic actor Gene Wilder. Wilder starred in such classic films as The Producers, Blazing Saddles, and Young Frankenstein. He's written a new book titled Kiss Me Like a Stranger, reflecting on the professional and personal events that have influenced his understanding of love and art. Recently, Mr. Wilder sat down with Robin Young, host of the WBUR program Here and Now. Greeting Robin to the stage is Cheryl White of Barnes & Noble at Boston University.
I want to welcome everybody to the Psi Performance Center at Boston University. Barnes & Noble at BU is so proud to present this special evening with Gene Wilder. When we first presented this idea of doing the event with Gene, he had one request only. He said, "Get me Robin."
Hi. Hi there. Robin Young, WBUR, Here and Now. There's a backstory there, which is that, a long time ago now, the Paleozoic era, I hosted a program that originated here in Boston called Evening Magazine. And in 1978 or 9, The World's Greatest Lover came out. And Gene Wilder, of course, was the star. It was his take on Valentino. How many of you have seen it? It's wonderful movie. And he was doing the tour, and Dom DeLuise was with him as well. And we went to the old Ritz-Carlton to do the interview, and I was a very serious 10-year-old, very nervous 20-something-year-old, and wanted to get it right, and I was being very serious with my interview, and he just kept, you know, he'd answer a question, and then he'd look at the camera and fling me down on the couch in a sort of faux kiss, and my legs would be kicking in the shot, and my arms waving, and I'd get up, and I'd say, "We cannot show lips on Evening Magazine." I don't know why I said that, but it's the first thing that came up. And then he would listen to another question, very earnest question, he'd fling me down on the couch again and do this big kiss, and then sit back up again. Well, fast forward 20 years later, in the mid-90s, I was working in Utah doing something, and walking through an airport, and darn if I don't see Gene Wilder, walking through the airport with a hat smashed down on his head and a sort of a rumpled khaki suit. He looked very international. He had two leather valises, one in each hand, brown leather shoes, and he's striding through the airport, head down, not looking anywhere. And I thought, oh, my God, I've got just a few seconds here to get his attention. Everybody probably bothers him. So I ran up alongside him, so nervous, not 20 anymore, and I said, "Mr. Wilder, I don't know how to say this, but you kissed me once in Boston." And he did not look up. He did not break stride. He said, "And you never call. You never write." The name of the new book, as you know, is Kiss Me Like a Stranger. I thought it was about me, but no. Let's find out what it's about. Welcome, Gene Wilder.
You don't need me.
Did I get the story right?
Yeah, that was right.
And I'm not in here, but a lot of other people are. Tell me why you started writing this book.
You start right out with a corker, don't you?
Yeah.
I had been asked to write a book maybe 3, 4, 5 times in the last 15 years, and I wanted to, but I said, "I'm not ready." I knew I wanted to write about my search for real love, not lust, not in like, not in lust, but real love, lasting love. And I wanted to write about my search for real acting, not how much money you can make in the publicity and the posters and all that, but the art of acting. Stanislavski, I thought of in those days. But I didn't know how to put it together. I didn't know what kind of structure that would hold it all. And then 2 years ago, someone very close to me got very ill and had to have a big operation. And I was in California with my wife, Karen, who's here now. And instead of staying for a week, we stayed for 2 months. And I started writing down all the ironies in my life, the accidents that changed the course of my life. And after a few pages, I said, "This is the structure I was looking for. I can fit it all into the crazy accidents that changed everything and caused..." Well, I'll tell you about them when you ask me later on. But So I started writing, and I wrote for a year and 8 months, and here I am selling books.
And here it is. And I know everybody wants to know about your relationships with Mel Brooks and Richard Pryor. I did want to note something that hasn't been mentioned as much in some of the interviews I've heard, which is, you know, your childhood and how you fell in love with the theater, looking at the stage when your sister was on it.
I was 11 years old, and my sister Corrine was doing what was called a dramatic recital at the Wisconsin College of Music. This was in Milwaukee, and it was an auditorium about half this size, and everyone was jabbering away and whispering and talking, and then the lights started to go down, then it was dark, everyone shut up, a spotlight hit the center of the stage, and out came my sister in this aqua gown, and you could hear a pin drop, and for 20 minutes she did this recital of Guy de Maupassant's The Necklace. And everyone watched her and listened to her, and I thought that that must be as close to actually being God as you could get. I probably didn't phrase it that way at 11, but it's what I felt. And I went up to her acting teacher afterwards, and I said, "Mr. Gottlieb, could I study with you?" And he said, "How old are you?" And I said, 11. And he said, "When you're 13, if you still want to, come back to me." And I called him the day after my 13th birthday, and I started studying acting.
Yeah. And born Jerry Silberman?
I was Jerry Silberman, Jerome, but everyone called me Jerry.
How did Gene Wilder come about?
Well, I got accepted into the Actors Studio, not when I was 13. This was, and Lee Strasberg was going to introduce me to all the people there, Ilya Kazan and Paul Newman and Shelley Winters and all the famous people. And I didn't want to be called Jerry Silberman because I was picturing it on a marquee. Jerry Silberman in Macbeth. So I thought about Look Homeward, Angel by Thomas Wolfe. And Eugene Gant, everyone who loved him called him Gene. And I loved that name. And my favorite play is Our Town by Thornton Wilder. And so I thought, put them together, Gene Wilder. And so I chose it, and then the next day he introduced me as Gene Wilder.
How did Mr. and Mrs. Silberman, I mean, how'd your family?
My mother was not alive at that point.
Right.
My father had a hard time for maybe a year or two. And then when I started working regularly, then he accepted it.
Then he became Academy Award nominated Gene Wilder, then it was good. Well, starring in so many films and stage productions, but let's talk about that one stage production that, as you write, it wasn't that happy an experience working with Jerome Robbins.
Oh, gosh.
But you met somebody's boyfriend.
Yeah, well, wait now.
Okay. All right.
Don't give away the punchline.
Oh, I'm sorry. Timing.
I was going to audition for Mother Courage by Bertolt Brecht. And Jerome Robbins was going to do it. And he wanted to see everyone who was a member of the Actors Studio to audition. And he liked me a lot. I was reading for the part of Swiss Cheese, the Mother Courage's son, for those of you who know the play. And he really liked it. And he asked me to read for the part of the pastor. And I read for it. And he asked me to come back again. And then another time. And then another time. 6 times altogether, which was illegal. You're supposed to pay an actor after 3 readings. And then it was down to me and one other actor, and I got the part, and I was thrilled till we got to the first day's rehearsal, and I realized that he didn't know what he was talking about. He knew about choreography, he knew about musicals, but he didn't know anything about doing a dramatic piece like this. But the star of the play was Anne Bancroft, whose boyfriend was Mel Brooks. So each evening after we started doing previews, Mel came backstage to pick her up, and the first time I saw him, he was wearing that Merchant Marine jacket. They called it a pea coat or a pea jacket, and I admired it. He looked so handsome in that, and I said, "I love that jacket." He said, "Yeah, they used to call it a urine jacket, but it didn't sell." And then he said, "I'm writing a movie It's called Springtime for Hitler. And would you like to come to Fire Island with Anne and me on some weekend, and I'll read you the first 30 pages? So I went one weekend in June, and we had dinner, and then he read, just for Anne and me, he read the first 30 pages, and it was wonderful. And he said, would you like to play Leo Bloom? I said, yes, I would. He said, okay, in the fall, don't take anything without checking with me first. And in September, I was offered One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, not the movie, the play with Kirk Douglas. And I called Mel up, and I said, I feel a little silly, but you said I should call you. He said, yeah. Can you get a 2-week out in your contract? I said, Mel, I'm not a star. They're not going to give me a 2. I said, maybe I can get a 4-week out. He said, all right, we have to live with it. 3 years went by. I never heard from him. I didn't get a telephone call, a letter, a telegram.
You never call, you never
write. Yeah. That's actually where I got it from. And one day I was doing a play called Love by Murray Schiskel, and I was taking off my makeup. This was on Broadway. And there was a knock on the door, and I opened the door, and there was Mel standing there with a tall gentleman behind him. I said, Mel. He said, you don't think I forgot, do you? He said, I've got the money now. This is Sidney Glaser, and he's going to produce Springtime for Hitler. And he said, you know, I love you, I want you to do it, but Zira Mostel has approval of whoever plays Leo Bloom. So would you come and read with him tomorrow? So I went to Sidney Glaser's office. My heart was, I thought they could see it pounding through my shirt, and I knocked on the door, and Mel opened the door. I saw Zira Mostel in the background, and he said, come on in. He said, Gene, this is Z. Z, this is Gene. And I put out my hand for him to shake hands, and he took my arm and pulled me up close to his chest, and he kissed me on the lips. And all my nervousness disappeared. And I believe now that he knew exactly what he was doing, because he knew actors and how nervous I must be, and he wanted me to feel free. And I gave a good reading, and I got the part. But that was all because of the irony of being miscast in Mother Courage. And if I hadn't been miscast and met Mel then, there wouldn't have been the producers, which was Springtime for Hitler, but it was later changed to the producers, Blazing Saddles or Young Frankenstein. I'd probably be making wallets in some neuropsychiatric ward.
Blazing Saddles, though, you weren't Mel Brooks' first choice. It was sort of an emergency.
No, he wanted me, for those of, do you know Blazing Saddles? Okay.
We could probably recite it if you'd like, but
Mel wanted me to play Harvey Korman's part. And I said, Mel, I'm all wrong for it. I wouldn't be funny. I said, but the Waco Kid. He said, no, I know, that's Anne's favorite part. No, I want a much older guy, over the hill, alcoholic, no. And about 6 weeks went by while he was filming, and I get a call from Mel. He said Gig Young was cast in that part of the Waco Kid. And on his first day of filming, he started foaming at the mouth on the way to the prison cell. And Mel thought it was some kind of method acting trick. It turns out he was on the wagon. And by the time he got to the prison cell, they had to call an ambulance and take him out. And Mel went right to a phone booth. And he called me at my home in New York, and he said, can you get on a plane and get here by tomorrow? I need you, and I want you to play the Waco Kid. And I said, I'm supposed to leave for London to do The Little Prince with Stanley Donen. He said, call him up. Tell him you have to do this for me. So I called Stanley Donen in London, and I told him the situation. He said, do you really want to do it? I said, well, I want to help Mel out. He said, all right, I'll put you at the end of the schedule instead of at the beginning. And I left the next day, and the following day I was upside down in the jail cell.
Saying, we're black?
Yeah. Are we black?
That's the scene with Cleavon Little, when you come out of some drunk stupor in the jail cell. You know, I was thinking that Blazing Saddles, I don't think that film would be made today. Do you? In the first 30 seconds, three slurs.
I think today of the three films, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, and The Producers, I think Blazing Saddles is the only one that they might make today.
Really?
I do. I don't think that they would do Young Frankenstein, and I'm almost positive that they wouldn't do The Producers.
Yeah, well, there's that.
And for the cost, you know, The Producers cost $947,000. Today, you know, if he could do it, it would maybe be $13 to $15 million. But the average small budget today is $40 million.
In fact, how much did Mel Brooks make making The Producers?
Not a penny. He was paid $50,000 for 2 years of work, and it didn't make it at the box office. And Joe Levine, who was the distributor, sold it down the river and sold it to television right away. It didn't even have a chance. And Young Frankenstein would cost a lot of money today, but I don't think they would do it. Maybe they would, but I don't think so.
I want to talk about Young Frankenstein, but before that, just the book gives us insight into just little twists and turns in all the different films that you made. For instance, do you remember what Woody Allen said when he called you? You were visiting your dad, I think, in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Woody Allen got my phone number there. I don't know how. And he said, I want to do a remake of Sister Carrie, and I want either you or Laurence Olivier. But instead of Jennifer Jones, I want to use a sheep. This was everything you always wanted to know about sex that he was doing. And I knew right away why he wanted me, because he wanted someone who would play it straight. Someone who you could believe had fallen in love with a sheep. And
did you?
And I did. And I found out later that that really cute sheep was a boy. And the standby, because you have to have an alternate in case one of them gets sick, the alternate was a girl, but the cute one was a boy, and he had a black ring around his eye. And Woody didn't talk to me during it. He said at about 10 in the morning, he said, did they tell you how to get coffee or tea or something? I said, yeah, they told me. And then at noon, he'd say, do you know where to go for lunch? I said, yeah. About 4 o'clock, he said, do you want tea or coffee? I said, yes, thank you. The only other thing he said to me was, by the way, if you don't like any of these lines, just say what you want, change them. Now, I wasn't sure, was he joking or what? And I realized it wasn't a joke, because the event, falling in love with a sheep, that was the important thing. What words I said, if I could say words that were more convincing for me, more believable for my faith in the situation, it was fine with him. He didn't care, as long as the event was portrayed truthfully. And that's what I did.
I want to talk about another film, again, before Young Frankenstein, which we want to spend some time on, but Willy Wonka. I loved reading how you were at... And you know, here's the thing.
You're a bunch of kids, you know.
I can't believe Willy Wonka was a flop at the box office.
Yeah.
What happened there?
I think it was the mothers who thought it was too harsh for the children. The children didn't think that.
Yeah.
They knew, without being able to describe it that way, they knew it was a morality play, and that, you know, if you pick your nose and chew gum too much and are a brat, that there are lines that should be drawn, and Willy Wonka was drawing them. I think the kids understood that.
Oh, but now you can't get it. You can't rent it. It's always out.
Yeah.
It's always taken, so...
Anyway.
Well, what the heck? but what I wanted to ask you about, Johnny Depp is recreating the role, you know. How do you feel about that? Can there be another Willy Wonka? I don't know.
Well, wait. First of all, I if they were going to do it, I think that they should have done The Wizard of Oz first and then done Willy Wonka. That was a joke, by the way. And second of all, if I were going to direct it, the first person, the only person really that I would have wanted to play it would be Johnny Depp, because he has something that's magical about him and something that's mysterious. And I think that's what's required. And if Tim Burton is writing and directing, it's not going to be like the Willy Wonka that you all know.
Mothers are really not going to like it.
I don't know this, but I think it's going to be scary with lots of... Why is that funny? No, I do. I think he'll have so many scary effects, visual effects and special effects. And I think it'll be more for teenagers than it will be for children. But that's a guess. I don't know. But I'm glad he's using Johnny Depp.
Yeah, although you'd rather not have it done.
If you gave me my choice, I'd say don't do it.
Right. Leave it the way it is. Well, Young Frankenstein. What happens when you sit down with a pad? You just finished the Woody Allen film.
Yeah.
And you sit down with a yellow pad and you come up with an idea that is Young Frankenstein. Did an anvil fall on your head? I mean, how does that happen?
It wasn't an anvil. I had just finished Everything You Always Want to Know About Sex. And like most actors, I wondered if I'd ever work again. And I got home and I took this yellow legal pad and a blue felt pen and I wrote Young Frankenstein. Now, if you asked me then why that, I wouldn't have known. But when I thought about it later on, I realized I had two influences. One was Mickey Rooney in Young Edison that I saw when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And the other was Anne Bancroft in Young Winston, the film that she made a few years earlier. So I suppose that's where the young came. And the reason I wanted to tell a story about me being, a doctor or a dental hygienist and finding out that Beaufort von Frankenstein, my great-grandfather, left me the Frankenstein estate from Transylvania. But I had to go to Transylvania to get it. That's all I knew at the start. And so I wrote that down. And I called Mel, and I told him the idea. And he said, cute. That's cute. I was looking for a little encouragement. He just said, cute. And my agent at the time, Mike Medavoy, who then became a big movie mogul, but he was my agent, he said, how about a movie with you and Peter Boyle and Marty Feldman? And I said, what made you come up with that idea? He said, because I now handle you and Peter and Marty. So I said, well, with such a wonderful artistic basis for a film, I happen to have something. Send it to me. I said, no, give me a couple days. I want to write a little bit more on it. And that night, I wrote the Transylvania station scene, almost verbatim, the way it is in the movie now. And I sent it off to him. And he called and said, I think I can sell this. And maybe we can get Mel Brooks to direct it. And I said, I don't think he'll direct something he didn't conceive of. The next day, I got a call from Mel. What are you getting me into? And I said, nothing you don't want to get into. He said, I don't know. You have to understand that he made $50,000 over 2 years on The Producers, and then he did The 12 Chairs, 2 years. He made $50,000 for the 2 years' work. So he was hungry, and they offered him a lot of money. I mean, a lot. Today it wouldn't be considered that much for a director, but it was about $250,000 or $275,000 to direct Young Frankenstein. And they got him, and we did it. Although, I don't know if you want to go into this part, but...
Every part. That it almost didn't get made because of the budget?
Columbia Pictures said $1,750,000 is your budget. And we had it budgeted for $2,200,000. And we were going to try and cut costumes and shooting time, cast salaries and everything. And just before we went into the office at Columbia Pictures, Mel hits himself in the head, which he does a lot, and he said, we're crazy. We should go in there and say, you guys are Cracker Jacks. It comes out exactly... We say 2,200,000. You say 1,750,000. So let's meet in the middle and call it 2 million. And Johnny Veitch, who was the executive in charge, said, That sounds reasonable. And he took it to his boss and he said, $1,750,000 and not one penny more, and you got 48 hours to set it up somewhere else. And the producer, Michael Gruskoff, took it to his friend Alan Ladd Jr. and he said, I'll take it. And we made it for $3 million. And then he asked Mel and me to sign contracts for 5 years with 20th Century Fox.
Yeah, a good ending. We should mention it also had the magnificent Madeline Kahn. You saw her singing I'm So Tired in Blazing Saddles and knew that she had to be in Young Frankenstein.
Well, I had never seen her before. And when I came to do Blazing Saddles, I met her, and then when Mel showed me the dailies from a little bit that he strung together, edited together, of Madeline singing I'm Tired as Marlene Dietrich, I thought that was worth the price of admission. And then I told Mel, that's who we should get for Young Frankenstein. But I was thinking of her playing Inga, the lab assistant that Terry Garr played. But Madeline said, I'd like to do it, but I want to play the fiancé. And Mel said, okay. And I think that she's probably the most talented actress I've ever worked with.
Yeah.
Funny, and I've seen her do dramatic, as she did in Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother. She can do both. Mm. She had a voice like an angel. She could sing opera, she could sing pop. And the rest of the cast, Cloris Leachman is the funniest actress I've ever worked with, I think, more than anyone.
Do people come up to you on the street? I mean, I know that in my life I find myself using lines all the time from Young Frankenstein. Like, someone will ask me, you know, did you date so-and-so? I'll say, yes, he was my boyfriend, yeah. And fling my arms out. Do people come up to you and just do that to you?
They don't do that one, but... But they do walk this way. And I'll tell you, when we were on the set in the back lot of MGM doing that scene at Transylvania Station, Mel suddenly said, Marty, take your little cane and bend over and then tell Gene, walk this way and then stoop down and walk away. And then Gene, you follow him trying to walk that way. I said, what does that mean? He said, I'll tell you later. So... He said, walk this way, and I did it, and I walked out. And then when it was all done, I said, would you tell me now, what does that mean? And he said, a man walks into a drugstore, he has a terrible case of hemorrhoids, and he needs some talcum powder. And he goes up to the druggist, and he says, have you got some talcum powder? And the druggist says, yes, sir, walk this way. He says, if I could walk that way, I wouldn't need the talcum powder. And he said, it's an old vaudeville routine. But I had never heard it before. Now people come up to me and say, walk this way.
I want to talk about another film relationship. You and Richard Pryor are one of the great buddy teams in film. Several films that you did together, Stir Crazy, Silver Streak. But you write in the book that as funny as he was, and it's one of the few times that you improvised in films, right?
Yeah, he taught me. I had improvised at the Actors Studio in classes a lot, but not professionally in front of a camera. Mm-hmm. But on Silver Streak... On our first day of filming, he said his first line, I said my second line, and then he said something that wasn't in the script, and I didn't think about it. I just answered him as naturally, logically, spontaneously as I could. Then he said another line, I said another line, and then we went back to the script, and every time we worked together, it was like that. I never knew what he was going to say, and I never knew what I was going to answer. And young people today, not just young people, can be older people, when they think they're improvising, they're really ad-libbing. I don't mean all, but so many ad-lib and try and think up clever lines. What's the funniest line I can come up with? That's not improvising. Mm. But to take a situation and explore it by improvisation is one thing. But my teacher, Lee Strasberg at the Actors Studio, said it's a tool. It's just like a hammer or a file, a saw. You don't use it if you don't need it. Only if you need it, like you're in trouble. Something's wrong with the script there or in the relationship and you want to say things that are in between the lines.
Yeah.
And that's how I learned it.
Can you give an example? It's not in the book, so I don't know if I'm putting you on the spot, but can you give an example of a line we might know from one of those films, or an exchange or a moment that wasn't in the script that just kind of came?
When we entered the jail cell in Stir Crazy, we only rehearsed the movements. We didn't rehearse what we were going to say, and Sidney Poitier was directing, and he didn't care about... He wanted us to fly when the camera was on. And all of a sudden, Richard says, "We bad." And I don't know what I said in response, but I started talking in Japanese, I think. But I didn't know I was going to do that, but something that he did caused me to do that.
It's so much fun, but you write that that's one of the relationships that didn't translate off the screen.
Well, we saw each other maybe four times when we weren't on camera, on the set. Mm. When we were together, it was fine, but we didn't see each other socially otherwise. He had his own crowd that he stayed with. I would have liked to have seen him, but he was much, much different when off camera than he was on camera.
And as you write, you found out later, perhaps problems with drugs and, you know, starting then.
I didn't know about it, yeah. But that was what it was during Stir Crazy, right. Not Silver Streak. Right. And not at all during See No Evil, Hear No Evil. But in Stir Crazy, it was that, but I didn't know it.
Well, as we said, the book is a search for art and love. And woven through all of the chronology of the films is the date that didn't work out, the first wife that didn't work out, the second wife.
You're telling me.
Didn't work out. Okay. But, you know, I obviously, and a marriage that very much worked out. And a marriage that was very famous and everyone wants to know about. And I think we'll be very surprised to hear you tell of it, because it wasn't what we thought it was.
Well, when I met the editor of this book for the first time, before she had decided that it was something that St. Martin's would want to do, we talked about different things from my first draft. And then she never said, this is Elizabeth Beyer, is her name. She never said, you should do this, you should do that. Why don't you do this? She always would just gently say, have you ever thought about talking about what it was like when you first met Gilda or why you married her? I know you wrote about what it was like when she got ill, but of course it's your book. You have to do what you want to do. And it set me thinking, and so a lot of what I wrote about Gilda in that first part before she got ill is because Elizabeth suggested that. That's the way she works. She said it lots of times about, she would say, did you ever think about writing about what goes through your mind when, as Leo Bloom, when you, the blue blanket and his, I'm hysterical and... the artistic process, and I said, you think anyone would be interested in that? Mm-hmm. She said, oh, I think so, but it's your book. She said, well, see, that's how she worked. But as far as Gilda was concerned, it was easy, it was fun writing about first meeting her on Hanky Panky, directed also by Sidney Poitier, and then getting to know her, and then when the film was over, and we were at Burbank Airport, she was tearful, and she had clung to me so much that I thought she was going to start to grow another growth out of my arm or something. And I kissed her goodbye, and she said, oh, if you ever want to get in touch with me, call my manager, Bernie Brillstein, and say, the ducks are quacking in the pond. I said, all right, dear. And she left. I got to my home. This was in California. She was on her way to New York. And I breathed a sigh. I'm free. I don't have that pest pulling on me anymore. And then the next morning, I woke up. I went out. I got orange juice, milk, butter, English muffins. I had dinner with a friend that evening. I came home, walked across my living room towards the piano, took off my jacket halfway, and I stood like a zombie for 5, 6, 7, 8 seconds, and I dropped to my knees, and I started pounding the carpet on my floor, and tears came to my eyes, and I was pounding and pounding. It just overwhelmed me, and I realized, although I never did and don't ever wish to take drugs, it must have been like needing a fix. I got so used to her that I needed a fix. And I called Bernie Brillstein and I said, would you tell Gilda the ducks are quacking in the pond? And she called me from payphone on the street, and I invited her to come and stay with me in California, and she did. And then she spent the next year and a half trying to get me to marry her. Well, I loved her, but I said, I'll go crazy if I marry this girl, because she can't do anything without me. And I want her to be independent, and she'll just suck me dry. I won't know what to do anymore. And then we were going to go to France. I had just finished doing a film, and her dog, the little dog named Sparkle, ate rat poison in the lounge at the airport, and she saw it. I didn't. I thought, she's not going to eat rat poison. She's so particular about what she eats. And Gilda said, I believe she did, and I'm going to rush her to a vet now. And then she said these monumental words, you go on to France, you're exhausted and you need a rest. I know you love me, and you know I love you, and I'll be fine. So you go ahead, and I'll talk to you on the phone. I went to France, and I kept hearing her say those words over and over, and I said, that's what I was waiting for a year and a half. And I came back to Los Angeles after my 10 days in France, and I proposed marriage. And we got married, and things were fine for a while, but something she had told me late, before I asked her to marry her, was, before I asked her to marry me, and she told me that she was bulimic. And I didn't know what it was. She explained it to me, and then she said, but please don't ever try to monitor me. And it was very difficult because every evening in a restaurant or at home, she'd get up after eating her main course, go to some bathroom, throw up, take some gargle of some kind, came back, and then went about her business. But her teeth were starting to rot because of the acid from the vomit. And I tried to hold on. Don't talk about it. Don't talk. You said you wouldn't monitor. And she hired someone, a therapist, who came to the house, and she worked it, and she licked it. And it's as difficult to lick that problem as it is to get rid of a drug addiction. And she did lick it, and then she gets stage 4 ovarian cancer. And I wrote a lot about that in the book. I don't know if you wanted to go into that. I told you pretty much about it, but that's the first part. The second part is about when she was so ill. Yeah. And nearly drove me to distraction, because she treated every stranger with so much respect, everyone she met, except when she was going through the worst of it and the chemo, and they didn't have anything to take away the nausea in those days. And so when she was upset and going hysterical, she'd take it out on me. And if I ever got angry with her, which happened maybe 2 times, 3 times, she'd say, oh, thank you. I know if you thought I was going to die, you would have yelled at me like that. And it's true, because I never thought she was going to die, not till 3 weeks before she died. I always, always thought she'd pull through. It was divine stupidity, because everyone else knew, but I didn't. I must have shut something off in my brain. But I asked her at one point, you treat everyone you meet, even a stranger on the street, with respect. Why do you say such terrible things to me? And she said, because you're my husband. You're the only person I can let it out on. And I understood it, but when she tore into me, it was so hard. And I knew she was suffering from all the stuff, fear of death, and the nausea from the chemo. And anyway, so that's that.
It's very difficult. And given that you wanted to write such an honest memoir, I don't see how you could have written it without including all of that. But it's tough for people who so adored her to read it.
Well, people, when they hear about marriages of celebrities, they think, oh, what an ideal couple. They don't know what... Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. Ideal couple. I've only met about three couples, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, Hume Crone and Jessica Tandy, and...
Mel and Ann,
yeah. Mm-hmm. There are very few, but people read about it in People magazine, and they think everything is ideal. Well, it's not, except for one exception, the only one I can honestly think of, and that's my wife Karen and me.
Yeah. Karen's here. How is she? And I'm not going to belabor this any more than I already have. You met Karen, after, and that was also difficult for you because everyone's coming up to you. I came up to you at one point.
Yeah.
I saw you in New York and said, it's a good year leader.
I'm so sorry,
you poor guy. And meanwhile,
well, the irony is because the book is about irony. The irony is I was offered a script called See No Evil, Hear No Evil. I turned it down. 6 months later, my agent, the same agent, said, sent me a script called See No Evil, Hear No Evil. And I said, are you crazy? I just read this 6 months ago and turned it down. And I changed agents, not because of that, for something else. And I was with Marty Baum from CAA, and he said, I've got a script here called See No Evil, Hear No Evil. And I want you to meet the people at TriStar. I said, Marty, I turned it down twice. I'm turning it down a third time. He said, I don't care. I want you to meet the people. So I went to TriStar and I met the people. And I told them everything that I thought was wrong with the script. And they said, we agree with you. And would you write it for you and Richard Pryor? So I said, well, I'll write 20 pages. I'll start from scratch using the same plot, though. You like it? I'll go on. You don't like it? You don't owe me a penny. I wrote it. And they said, that's the film we want to make. And I said, now I've got to find out about the hearing impaired because that's who I was playing. And my wife really should tell you this story, but I'll make it brief. But I had my secretary call the New York League for the Hard of Hearing, and I was put in touch with a Ms. Webb. I was supposed to call a Ms. Webb. I said, oh, Jesus, my luck. This is going to be some New England biddy who's going to say, well, you're making fun of the deaf. Is that what you want to do? So she calls, or I call, she's on the phone, and I hear this beautiful voice, and she said, it's a very funny script, and it'd be wonderful with you and Richard. I said, oh, thanks, I'm glad you like it. She said, of course, it's full of errors, and I made an appointment, and I went to the New York League for the Hard of Hearing, and out comes this vision. In a lavender and pink and a little bit of blue skirt flowing just below the knee, flowing back and forth. And she puts me down, her name was Karen Webb, Ms. Webb. She puts me down in front of a monitor and said, let's see what you can make out of the lip reading. They call it speech reading there, but what do you think this person is saying? And the image comes on, and it's her. And it's about this big, and I'm trying to see what is she saying, and I say a few words that I thought I got right, and she said, let's do it a little closer, and she does it about like this, and I look at it, and I say, I guess a few more words, then the next one is just her lips. I said, God is putting me through some test here. And I thought I did pretty well. And I said, so, how'd I do? And she said, fair. And then she sent me to an audiologist and then other things, and to beginners, intermediate, and advanced lip reading classes. And I could ask any question of the people in the classes. How does it feel when someone says this or that? Or that? And she said, if ever I get the money for this grant, I want to do a video to help people who can't come to New York but maybe live in Des Moines or Idaho or something, and they're losing their hearing. Would you help me? And I said, sure. Several months later, after Gilda had died, I get a call from Ms. Webb. She said, I have the money now to do it. Would you still help me? I said, sure. And she sent me the script, a temporary script, and I said, this script is going to close on page 4. That's what Zero Mostel told me and the producers. So we met at an Italian restaurant in New York. She put a tape recorder on the center of the table, and I improvised, and she had a brilliant plan of little sketches. How do you read someone's lips if they're chewing gum? What if they have the guy has a mustache on? What if there's a shadow across his face? What are you supposed to do? So I would just improvise with these situations, and then we met again a week later, and she put the tape recorder down, and we did the same thing. The third time, I said, this time, leave the tape recorder at home. And that's when we had our first date.
You know, it sounds like such a wonderful movie, you know, especially the scene where you're trying to concentrate on what they're saying as you're looking at those lips. But what we read in the book is that this sort of, you know, all these parallel lives, the acting and looking for love, sort of converge at this moment. And you also, let's throw in that you also battled your own cancer. Yeah. And there was a moment when it seems as if you came to the conclusion that, you know what, I have found this terrific love, and I don't need...
Don't give away the punchline.
Well, I won't. I guess you tell us what you want to say, and my question is, have you stopped? Have you given up acting?
I'm acting now.
Oh.
What was the question?
Well, I don't want to give away, if you don't want me to give away, the ending where you feel this fullness.
Oh,
yes,
yeah.
You feel this fullness.
Well, I got this cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and then I had a lot of chemo, and they produced a lot of stem cells, and I went in for a stem cell transplant. Not the embryonic stem cell, but
your own.
From my own blood. And then I went into Sloan Kettering, and... radiation, and then heavy, heavy chemo, and then they came in and sang Happy Birthday with my stem cells thawed out because they were frozen, and they infused them back into my bloodstream, and I knew that there was a fair chance that I would die. I didn't think I would, but I thought, if I do, I have no complaints. I'm married to the woman I love. I've had a wonderful career and a charmed life. And so, no regrets. As it happens, this is my 5th year and I'm in complete remission now.
Is there, you know, this did take up a bit of your time, you know, having all your stem cells thawed and injected and everything. But the sense that I got was that you had this feeling of love. And so maybe didn't need, you know, the adoration of everyone or need to prove something on stage. And it sounded as if maybe you wouldn't do any acting. And that would be a real loss.
No. I do go into this in the book because I thought it was so terribly important that I wish I could... I think most actors start out because they weren't loved for their true selves, but because of something they could do. Sing a song, do a dance, tell a joke, and then someone starts this, and then they start to think that they love them, that they love him or her. And then they think of doing it professionally, and then they become actors, and then the audience applauds, and then Sally Field says, you love me, you really, really love me. They don't love her, they love her performance, but they don't know her. How could they love her? And I do want to act again if I could ever find a really good script, but I don't need to act for those old reasons. I felt like Holden in Catcher in the Rye. I wish I could catch all the young actors and let them know that they may think it's love, but that isn't what they're loving in you. It's what you just did that they love. And when you find someone who really loves you for your true self, then that's love.
Okay, so I won't be saying how much we love Gene Wilder.
Yeah.
At the end of it. Have you read Drama of the Gifted Child?
Is the Pope Catholic?
There you go. Okay. So, yeah, great book, by the way, on that topic. I just wanted to say that, I respect your statement that your many thousands of fans, of course we don't know you the way Karen does or the way the people who know you do, but you have shared so much of yourself in your films and here tonight that I think we do know you a little bit, and I think we do love you a lot. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to legendary comic actor Gene Wilder as he spoke with Robin Young, host of the WBUR program Here and Now. Mr. Wilder spoke about his career on stage and in film. He also spoke about his years with actress and comedian Gilda Radner. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skoll and Matt Odette, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.